And between the story I'm telling you about the secret meetings in Oxford, I went in summer and stayed with Alixa Rothschild in a place called Reux, where she was mayor, the village near Deauville. The Halbards were staying in Deauville. I saw them both, and they came to see Alix, a great friend of Hans Halbard and so on. But it was plain that he, so to speak, suspected might be something. And I think I must have written her a letter, because she tore it up on the beach in Deauville, and he picked up all the little bits and stuck them together.
Fantastic, like in a real roman.
I don't know if the letter contained anything very compromising, actually. But he was beaten with jealousy. I don't blame him. Jealousy is a very violent emotion, which I recognize. I don't know if he's in love with her or not, but he wanted to remain married to her. Then, at the end of 1953, I was discovered. I went to the chemist, I bought things I didn't want to buy. Went out, they were still talking to each other, corner of High Street. I went back to All Souls. More dead than alive. He then telephoned me. And I remember Bill Deakin came to see me about then. I told him all this, what had happened. He was more amused than sympathetic. But anyway, and he telephoned me and said, will I come and see you? Halban. So I went along to Eddington House, where they were already living. And I had to talk to him, and he said, look. I said, look, you're perfectly right. I can't say anything. I have no criticism to make of you. You're behaving perfectly naturally. Your wife, I'm in love with your wife. You are a husband. You must obviously hate it. And the fact that you are indignant and want us to discontinue is perfectly natural. And I have no possible argument against it. Except one. I wish to give a piece of advice. I am rather biased on this matter, so you needn't accept it, because clearly I have an interest. So I can't pretend to be objective, but I wish to tell you that if you imprison her, as you've done, and forbid her to see me, as you have done in the past, she'll escape, as she has done already. You will not be able to lock her up forever. The prisoner is more anxious to escape than the jailer to keep them locked. That's an invariable story. So I recommend you, I advise you, not to do it. Because in the end, you'll see, it'll lead to another crime. It can't be helped, I don't say. It will. But that is a piece of consideration I would like you to bear in mind. Which I meant. He then said, all right, go and talk to Aline.
You?
Yes. Ask her what she wants to do. So I went for a walk with Aline in the garden of Eddington House. Dr. Halbard rushed out and put a letter in my hands. He said, I accept your argument. I think it would be good if you could see her once a week. That led to a ridiculous situation. She used to come to tea with me in All Souls once a week. That was sufficient, as far as I was concerned, for the situation. So I went on having tea quite peacefully, quite nice, and I mean, he didn't seem to mind. In this way, things went on a little until about, I should say, the early summer of 54. Then she telephoned me one day. I was standing in the Portered Lodge. She got through to that. And she said, I can't bear it any longer. He's gone. He's left me. I've done it. I've sent him away. I'm coming at once. After that, all was well. She talked about it to him. She just found the situation unbearable. And he agreed to go. She paid him a very large sum of money. Without that, it could not have been done. He removed every object which he happened to have in his room, including his Cezanne, which belonged to her, and removed himself to Paris, where shortly afterwards he married an even richer wife. But, and then we, this is about late summer 54. No, what am I talking about? Yes, I think that's right. Yes, I think after that we went on holidays together, we saw a great deal of each other, and in late 55, I think it was the beginning of 55 maybe all this. No, it was 55. No, 54 is what I was telling you about. 54 is the trouble here. No, 55, about spring. The summer was very happy, we saw each other. Great deal, non-stop, and then we really were in love with each other and everything was very happy. I proposed marriage to her. In the botanical, she didn't want to marry particularly. She thought we could go on like this. It was a kind of unofficial, didn't mind a sort of what it's called a faux ménage. I mean, simply as lovers. But I said, no, marriage or nothing always. I wanted marriage. And so I proposed to her the botanical gardens of the Oxford University, which she said, well, it must be. Which she then accepted. No other way out. All right. Very well then. I then went to America, to Chicago, for 2 months, the university. She came to see me there. We traveled back on a kind of honeymoon boat, back to England. We were married in the Hampstead Synagogue in February 1955. Her witness was Victor Rothschild. My witness was Eliyahu Elat. Our mothers were there. There were about 5 people at the wedding, maybe 7. A perfectly good Jewish wedding. And then we went to stay the night at the Ritz Hotel. And then we traveled about and so on, went to Russia that year, and so on, 56. That's the story.
And then you started...
It was a romance. There was a romance.
A real romance. Now...
I never thought, didn't even think
it could happen.
To me, no.
But, was it your first love? Or, I mean, when you were younger, you
no,
love.
No.
But it was not as mature as that.
It was not my first love. I was not in love when I was attracted by girls in the 30s. Not at school. But in the 30s, 1 or 2 years. Nothing happened. I mean, they don't think they particularly liked me. I had, in effect, proposals of intimacy from people I did not want. There was a girl who was in love with me very greatly, called Miss Walker, who was a pupil of mine. And she was so passionately in love that I thought perhaps I was in love with her. But I think I recovered in time. It was clear to me. She subsequently went mad, so perhaps I was wise. But anyhow, she was a kind of hunting, shooting lady, who was particularly unsuitable. In the middle, later, very clever, married a curious girl, still alive, I think, in her loony bin. And her nephew is Edward Mortimer.
Mortimer.
She's Mortimer's aunt. She was his mother's sister. I could have done, yeah. But I wasn't in love with her. At least I thought perhaps I was. We had a romance. But it was... it's a little crazy. During the war, there was a lady from Israel who obviously developed feelings for me, whose name was Haverbuch. She married a composer called, a tonal composer called Volpe.
Ah, yes, Volpe.
There is a composer.
There is. Yes.
He's dead, I think.
I know.
He lived in America, I think. And she married Walter. She was called Haverbucher.
You met her where?
In London, because she came from Riga, friend of my aunt. She was a sort of lady from Riga, my family knew. They knew the father. They knew the family. But she was rather hysterical, quite pretty. But it's in New York that she laid siege to me, I say ungallantly. But I knew that was no good. But then she married Volpe. She wrote me letters. I was in love in Washington during the war, quite extremely. It was not returned. I mean, we saw each other a great deal. I was very much liked, but I didn't, no affair. With a lady called Lady Patricia de Benton.
Benton,
let me explain. Her name was Patricia Douglas. She was the daughter of Lord what was the name of Oscar Wilde's lover, Alfred Douglas?
Ah, yes, of course.
Who is Lord what? What is his father called?
Wasn't he Douglas?
No.
But I know
Douglas is a family name.
I know the name.
No, what is the Lord?
I can't remember now, but I find it...
I was remembering it.
Ridiculous
not to. Ridiculous not to. Wait a minute.
I know.
The name was... it's an earl of some sort.
You will find it.
Anyhow, she was Patricia Douglas, daughter of the relevant lord. She was a great niece of Alfred Douglas. She was extremely pretty and very attractive, had a strong character and very fascinating, and is still alive. I met her in Washington. She was a tremendous liar. She got herself to Harvard. She was married to him. Now, who is Benton? There was a man called Baron Hirsch. Baron Hirsch had a natural son who he adopted and whom King Edward gave a title to and called the Forest, because Hirsches happened to be found in forests. He was made a baron by Francis Joseph at the request of King Edward. He was called Baron de Forest, became a member of Parliament. He got a graf, got a countship from the Grand Duke of Liechtenstein. He became finance minister of Liechtenstein, fallen through Benton, called himself de Benton in England. His second son was called John de Benton. He's alive, very nice man, and he was married to this lady. So it was wartime, he was in the army. Although he was a Liechtenstein citizen, he was a volunteer, and he was taken prisoner by the Italians.
So,
she was very attractive. I fell madly in love with her. I stayed with her. She, by forging some documents, she got herself into Radcliffe College at Harvard by forging a certificate from school. With the real forgery, she wrote to her in the end. She was not very faithful to anybody. She was very sick. Sex was wrong. When she was Marlene Dietrich said in that great song, von Kopf bis Fuß zur Liebe angestellt. She was love was her element. But I was in love. And I used to go and stay with her at Cambridge Mass. We were great friends. And I saw a great deal. And then, I don't know the... Anyway, she went back to England. Her husband was interned in Switzerland after running away. And then she divorced him because she had gone on living with him. And then she offered me marriage, which I refused. Yes, in 1945. I realized it was madness. I was terribly in love still. But She was too promiscuous, too far. I mean, it's impossible. She was, just scared that faithful she couldn't be to anyone. But, I mean, I was in love. I didn't really like her very much. I loved her. But I didn't like her that much. I rather disapproved of her. I didn't like form of life. I didn't like the Mendez. I didn't like the, so to speak, attachment to sex. But there's no doubt her company was delightful. And she had a number of affairs, each with all kinds of people. My brother-in-law, Aline's brother, Philippe, had an affair with her for a week in Paris, during which she went mad with love, he told me. She was undoubtedly attractive. And she, lots of people, she married a Yugoslav man who kept an antiquity shop in somewhere in Chelsea, with a drug-taking sort of abnormal figure of some sort. That's what she liked, really. He lived with three ladies. One she is married to, one is Patricia, whom he ultimately married, and one he was not married to. The one he was not married to married Urani. Albert.
Really?
Yes. So Patricia occasionally used to come to Oxford to see her husband's stepchildren. She was in quite good terms with Urani. But I was clear that I couldn't marry her. And I then went to Moscow in 45 and received a letter from the present Lady Avon, Clarissa Churchill, more or less saying that I was very nice when I was at Oxford. I was very pure and good. But since then I was corrupted by London society, which is not for me. I really must recover myself, and I mustn't live that kind of life. It really sprang her extreme dislike for Patricia Dependent. And I thought that this was monstrous, and so somehow she was both jealous and disapproving. She wasn't in love with me, but...
She was in love with you.
I don't think so. Lady Avon, no.
No?
In love, not. But rather possessive. Rather possessive in those days. But it took the form. She denies she ever wrote the letter. But the letter is probably in my papers somewhere. Anyhow, it was a very violent letter telling me that really I mustn't go on like this. I must return my pure Oxford life instead of going to all these dinner parties with all these society people who in the end would deeply corrupt me. Well, I came back from Moscow and resumed life. Went to Washington, as you know, from Moscow to first Oxford. And then I was gone with the story. It was quite amusing. I continued to be in love with Patricia. But it was clear to me that I wasn't going to do anything. She was unhappy. She had nobody. She had an affair with somebody called Alistair Forbes, who is a well-known journalist. Making good guy writes things in England. Then she had an affair with somebody else, I think. Her husband, Dependent, became secretary of Duff Cooper in Paris, and I used occasion to stay with him in Paris. And I continued being in love with her, but it was no good. It's quite clear to me. Not quite so clear to her. She, from time to time, wondered whether it might be a good thing. She divorced him, married me. I was absolutely clear that I'd be unhappy for the rest of my life. I found various ladies attractive in those days. Affairs I had none. Then, I remember the following happened. The summer of 46. I had a friend called Elliot Felkin, who was a Cambridge graduate, who was the secretary of the Opium Commission of the League of Nations, the controller of the opium trade. During the war, it was transferred to Washington. So he was there with a friend of his, and I knew him, and I knew his daughter, who was a pretty girl, who closer to Red Clifton was Patricia's best friend. In 1945, after I had been 46, and I came back to Oxford in January, Felkin telephoned me that his daughter wanted to get her in Oxford College. And could she come and see me and discuss it? They both came to lunch with me in New College. In the street just before lunch, I met Freddie Eyre. I said, why don't you come to lunch? Michael Felkin, quite an interesting, great friend of all these Bloomsbury people, Keynes, Virginia Woolf, that sort of man. Quite a pretty daughter. He came. Then he left. And I said to poor Penelope, he's a very dangerous man. Very Don Juan, you know. I shouldn't have said that. When I came back from Russia, no, from America, the summer of 46, I found poor Penelope Felkin here, still in the New College, still trying to work her way into it, looking rather unhappy. I asked her why she was unhappy. She wouldn't say. Then I met Freddie Eyre. He mentioned her name. I thought, ah. So then finally she came to tea with me, and she looked utterly miserable. So finally I said to her, look, something's the matter. She broke down and said she might be pregnant by Freddie Eyre. She went to a doctor. It's a false alarm. All right. Then Freddie went to Paris, where he duly fell in love with Patricia de Bendon. Penelope, who is our best friend, then decided to make the great sacrifice of our friend to this other lady with whom he was in love. Then, when Penelope was in Paris staying with Patricia, they talked about Freddie, naturally enough. Oh no, then Patricia Bender rang me up in Oxford. She thought, what to tell me this was happening. And I said, well, all right. She thought he might marry him, that's the point. He thought he might marry her. In fact, I think he practically almost acquired a house which they were going to live. He really was deeply in love. Really, yeah. And then while they were in Paris, they talked about it, and they talked about their mutual love for him. And then they did a thing which you will seldom do. They showed each other his love letters to them. They were identical. Text was absolutely identical. There were two letters to each of which was a facsimile of the other. He wrote absolutely mechanically the same letters to each.
Freddie?
Yes. Then they both broke with him. And they telephoned me, both of them, and told me this. Freddie was rather upset and couldn't understand why. Asked me if I knew anything about it. I said, no, I know nothing. Last thing I wanted was mixed up in this. However, that was the end of that. But in 1947, when I went to stay in Aix-en-Provence, this is 46, I think I was still in love with Patricia to some extent. Not desperately, perhaps. I always hoped I'd lose this feeling. And in the end, I fell in love with Eileen, and that cured me, so to speak, because one is always in love with somebody unless one love fixes another object. In 1950, I fell in love with somebody else, but I won't tell you who it is, because of reasons, which is best not to say. And nothing happened very much. But that went on until I finally married Eileen in 55. It was quite passionate and very satisfactory to both sides. And the only crime I committed was not to tell this lady that I was going to marry Eileen. She discovered it from somebody else, and that was very bad. Bad of me, undoubtedly. And all right, everybody requested to recover from it in the end. And I married her February 55. So if you ask me but my love life, that is all I have to report. On some future occasion, I might be able to tell you the identity of this person. But so long as both she and her husband are alive, it's better not to. Nobody knows this, except Aline and the husband. Well, no, nobody else. Nobody else known to me.
Now, during, then, when you married and started married life and started the process that you say, you lost friends, you gained friends, Aileen lost friends, you gained friends, how did it really work? How was it? I mean, naturally, you wanted to go on keeping your company with...
No, I used to go to New College to begin with. No, to All Souls, I mean. There were certain common friends. Freddie, I was a common friend. Stuart Hampshire was a common friend. John Sparrow was a common friend. Maurice Bauer and yours both. I remember that when I became engaged, in effect, I became engaged to her before she divorced Alba. I couldn't be announced. But in fact, we agreed to marry. The divorce went through in Paris because they both raised in Paris, so it wasn't difficult. But I remember it had been kept secret. But various persons discovered it. Various rather because I told them, because Aline told them. I remember having to tell Maurice Bauer, whom I didn't tell it to for a long time, my great friend. When I told him, he said, only possible person. Only possible person. I wasn't going to marry anybody. He decided it's the only possible person. And James said to me, well, she's beautiful, she's rich.
Joel.
He
was that close to you that you were... Who?
And to her. It's the madness, you see. And Alba was there. You see, Alba was there because in those days, Aline used to ask me, can't I get him made? Something. I got him made, number of common with Bottom, and I talked to Bill about him. About the madness. Then Lindemann, who was his patron, also talked to Bill. And that's how James came to our lives. And James liked Germans anyway. He must have some German blood. James, he can't be purely English. Can't.
I'm going to see him on Wednesday.
By all means.
It's clear that, after all, Aline lived in Oxford, so as you said...
I moved to her. No, the only thing is this. I moved to our house on the day after our marriage, 48 hours later. My difficulty was the children, of course. Michelle came to the wedding, wore a bowler hat, which she bought to the occasion. There was a little reception in my mother's house in Hampstead. My father was dead. My father realized that I loved her. My father died in 53.
And he realized?
In 53, we were staying in Monte Carlo, and the Albans were staying in, I think, Cap Martin or somewhere, south of France. And yes, he did. I don't think it's concealable by 53 from the people like my... He said, I can't understand. You love this lady, but she has... Three children, you can't marry somebody. Three children. It's absurd. My mother didn't talk about it. No. My father did. But then when he died, in the December, I think it was December, 53, I came flying back from Harvard. You see, he had leukemia. And he didn't know what leukemia meant. He never heard the word. So he didn't know he was dying. I knew he was dying. My mother knew he was dying. He thought it's, low blood pressure, anemia. He took various medicines. It was just done to keep him in, so to speak, pure and I mean keep his morale up. And then I thought, should I not go to Harvard in the autumn of 53? I thought, no, it'd be suspicious. If I didn't go, it'd be terrible. But I must come back in time. Well, my mother, of course, wanted not to tell me until last in the end she telephoned me. I came flying back. And I still saw him before he died. And I said to him, have you been offered the wardenship of Nuffield? It was exactly then.
What's
that? In the end of 53. He said, no, 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 you mustn't take it. No, it's not one of the good colleges. No, no, I wouldn't. He was against it. Ian Sparrow, the only people who were against it. Sparrow said, if you want to be nearer the station, the jail is even nearer. And then he died. And then I was terribly upset. Because I loved him very much, my father. And probably, my mother was much more of a character. My father was a gentle, sweet... You never met him, did you?
No.
He was a sweet, gentle, amiable, civilized man who liked nothing more than French comedies and that kind of thing, and liked to polish his fingernails on Sunday mornings.
Really?
Yes. But I mean, he was a Hasid.
Yeah.
By origin, but still, he's very European, much more than my mother. He was her first cousin. Nevertheless, socially, he was a cut above her, because he was the favorite of the millionaire, was given a very good education. She was the daughter of a poor man who worked for the millionaire, though his mother was a cousin and so on. And he was an Anglomaniac, adored living in England. He lived in my rooms in New College during the war, when the Blitz was on, made great friends with David Cecil and everybody in New College. Got on extremely well with all these people, which I don't think my mother would have done. And she lived in a room. She wasn't allowed to live in New College, of course, those days. I mean, my aim. And I was terribly upset by my father's death. And on the occasion of coming back after his funeral, 2 days later, I think, I was given a lift by Aline from London to Oxford. She came to the funeral, of course, and then gave me a lift. That's when I proposed to her. Not married, that's when I declared myself in the car en route to Oxford. Because I was obviously in an emotional state. That's what did it. Psychologically speaking, I was in some sort of uplift. He had a disturbed state, yes. Emotional uplift state, and I talked a lot. Suddenly I couldn't believe it anymore. Aline did not then say, oh, terrible. Not at all. Not at all. Not at all. She responded very immediately. And then this difficult life was Dr. Halban began. So I saw that the relation was a real relation. She didn't say, no, no, certainly not. What do we know? No, no, nothing of that. None of that. Not at all. Not at all.
And then, of course, when did you tell your mother?
Oh, fairly late. I think I told my mother in 54.
And what was her reaction?
She was so relieved that she was a Jewess. The probability of my marrying was quite high. I could have done it. It wasn't impossible. Not impossible. There was nothing concrete, but I could have done it. The fact that she was Jewish, and what's more, a Ginsburg, wonderful. Baron Ginsburg was God. Rothschild was even more divine. But Ginsburg was godly, God enough. And then she met her, and she said to me, after about three meetings, she wasn't sure it was a good thing. She said, she's genuinely in love with you. Of that is no doubt. That's all she wanted to be sure of. I wasn't so sure. But she was quite clear. You see, there's no doubt about it. My Aunt Ida liked her very much. She liked Ida much more than she ever liked my mother, Eileen. She was much, her point of view, she was more easier. My mother was too much of a full-blooded Russian Jewess of Yiddish-speaking origins, you see what I mean, Eileen. But my aunt said, well, she's very nice, but gemütlich she's not. Which is true. In her sense of coziness, what the Russian call, what is the Russian word that? She said that, uyutni is the Russian word.
Gemütlich, I mean...
Cozy.
Gemütlich is cozy?
Yes. Well, what is it? It must be the probably Yiddish word for it. Hebrew, I doubt.
Gemütlich is something you describe usually, Viennese Jews, that Gemütlichkeit, you know.
Yes, of course. But it means yes. But look, it must be a Yiddish word for people. Yes. It's probably the same word.
Yes. I don't know Yiddish enough.
Nor do I. Yes. But I can't tell you. But I mean, the Russian word exists. Yes. The French word doesn't exist.
Probably.
It means warm and warm and easy to get on with. Easy going and warm.
Yes,
affectionate, easy, warm. And so on.
Yes, yes.
I mean,
very interesting.
More or less what my aunt herself was.
Yes.
My mother much less. Who do you know, Dr. B? It's a very obvious psychological characteristic.
Oh, yes.
Some
yes.
people have it, some don't.
Oh, yes, sure.
Pussy is quite gemütlich.
I was going to say.
You were.
I had her in
you
mind.
See, she's quite gemütlich.
She's
gemütlich. Yes.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Exactly what she is.
Yeah. That's what I had in mind.
She is.
So we think of the same
that's,
thing.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
People we both know. I'm trying to think there aren't all that many ladies. Who else do we know? Lady Dahrendorf pretends she is. I'm not at all sure that she is.
But it's incredible. That's what I was going
next
to say.
Next person pretends.
She pretends and she's
not. Not.
But it's incredible. I mean,
telepathy is a remarkable thing. Telepathy.
Fantastic.
You see? Telepathy. Wait a moment.
Exactly.
Who else do we know?
Yeah.
Yeah, what other women do we know together?
Fantastic.
Really. Yes. People like Mrs. For example, Michelson is gemütlich.
Whom I know less.
Less, but she is. By nature, she is. A jolly lady.
Yes.
And quite gemütlich. Warm-hearted. And very easy to be with.
Yes, yes.
You see?
Yes.
You can be vulgar and gemütlich. You can even be nasty in a way.
Yes, yes.
And still gemütlich.
Yes, yes. I know what you mean. I know
them. Guy Burgess was very gemütlich.
Yes, yes.
But they thought Eileen was, in some sense, rather cold, and she is. But I don't think I would have married somebody very gemütlich. I think I needed somebody else. I am rather producing, and I needed some kind of foil to this. Anyway, but that's it me. And my mother took it quite well. Did not object.
Now, you came to...
Never felt completely easy in her presence.
Who?
No, my mother. Wasn't her kind of person.
You see, I remember one lunch at your house.
Yes.
Where Eileen was, Eileen's mother, your mother, Batya, and myself.
Well,
And your mother dominated the scene.
Because talked away. She talked so much.
And I was impressed by the fact that she felt so free.
Quite.
But maybe it was not that free.
No, it wasn't nervousness.
It was not
no. No, it was sheer strength of personality. inability not to do it.
Yeah, that's what I remember it.
She never sat shyly silent anyway. Yes. She's not shy, my mother.
Oh, not at all.
Not shy by nature. My mother-in-law is shy.
Your mother-in-law I met only once.
She was shy, yes.
I don't know whether she was old or shy.
She was a shy millionaires. That was not deserved. But shy she was. When they lived in Paris, they had no friends except people, clients. People came to lunch because they were rich and they could slightly look down on. Not many equals, and they were permanently embarrassed by the Rothschilds, who was, as it were, one class above.
That's the mother and Aline's mother.
Well, the same thing. I only met him once in my life. He came to Oxford to see the Albans, and then she came, brought him to see me, they took Russian to him. He's charming. He looked like Pétain.
Aline's father?
Yes. Didn't look Jewish at all. He's gentle, sweet, rather shy, very, very private, rather locked up, very, very gentlemanly. That he was. That he was.
Now, are you fine, Jack?
Well, I'm getting you.
I think that you are.
Quite 5 years.